in between the diameter of the other two. The largest diameter ones are the microtubules. You can see that right here. They're pretty wide. Microfilaments are the thinnest. And then in between those two extremes are intermediate filaments. And microtubules are the ones that I said act as roadways. That's one major function. For most of the lifetime of the cell, when it's busy being whatever kind of cell it is, things get moved from one place in a cell to another by motor proteins that walk along these microtubules. Then when it comes time for the cell to split into two, which depending on the type of cell, that could be either mitosis or meiosis, that also involves microtubules to make sure that chromosomes go the right place. We'll study that later. 18, though, gives you a cartoon view of one of these motor proteins walking along a microtubule. And that's not just a cartoon. Here's the real thing. These actually have two little legs, these motor proteins, and they take one step at a time, connecting and then disconnecting and then reconnecting farther down the microtubule length. Each individual step requires energy in the form of ATP, so it's expensive to move things around. But the vesicle that's shown on there is what the motor protein is carrying. It can be just about anything, but a vesicle is a little bag of membrane packaging something for movement around. In 19, we can see the three components, the three kinds of proteins that make up the cytoskeleton compared to each other. Now you can clearly see that the microtubules are the largest diameter ones, the microfilaments are the smallest ones, and then in between are the intermediate filaments. The microfilaments are not just the smallest. What I'll say about those is that they are important for contractility, the ability for muscle cells, for instance, to contract. This is how you're able to move around. Muscles can only pull, they can't push. But the reason that they're able to pull is because microfilaments of two different types increase their overlap between each other. You know, for instance, when I overlap my fingers more and more, my thumbs are moving closer to each other. That's kind of what happens in a muscle. The filaments themselves don't get shorter, just like my fingers are not getting shorter. They just overlap more and more, and that pulls things toward the center. Intermediate filaments are pretty much just anchors. They hold things in place. They're made of keratin, and keratin is very strong stuff. That's why your hair and nails feature keratin. It holds up to abuse. 20. Well, we're back to the centrosome and the centrioles in it. Remember, I said that I can't really tell you what centrioles do. I can only tell you that the centrosomes in animals contain centrioles, whereas centrosomes of other organisms don't, like plants, for instance. The centrosome, though, still is not shown really as a structure. It's just this yellowness. If that were a plant centriole, you wouldn't have these licorice-looking centrioles in there. But plant centrosome. But the centrosome is really important because it is where these microtubules grow from. And when it comes time for mitosis or meiosis, which is basically the end of the life of that cell, when it's about to become two cells, there will be two centrosomes on opposite ends of the cell, and the microtubules that grow from them will interact with each other and with chromosomes to make sure each of the two cells that results from the splitting gets a fair share of chromosomes. 21. Well, we mentioned flagella before, and we mentioned a sperm, which you're looking at right there as an example of a flagellated cell. There's all kinds of unicellular organisms that have flagella as well. It is a locomotory device, meaning it is there for the purpose of locomotion, for propelling the cell from point A to point B. It's a long whip-like tail, so it just pushes on the fluid that it lives in. there are much shorter projections from the cell called cilia in certain cells. Cilia is the plural of cilium, which means hair. And that's just because they kind of look like hairs to us. It's not true hair. The only true hair is made by mammals. This is much smaller. This is a subcellular structure. But cilia, like flagella, can aid in locomotion as well. That's true for a free-living cell, a cell that is not attached to anything. So a ciliated cell for a microorganism, a unicellular ciliated cell, by the beating back and forth of these cilia can make it tumble and move from point A to point B through the fluid. So it does. It can do a similar thing compared to a flagellum. But also, you have cells that are part of multicellular organisms, like your own body, and those cells are not free living. They're held in place. You know, they're part of an organ or a tissue. And the beating back and forth of the cilia is not about moving the cell through the medium in that case. It's about moving the medium past the cell. For instance, the cells that line that make up the epithelium that lines your trachea, your windpipe, those are ciliated and also mucus cells. They produce mucus. Mucus, by the way, mucus and mucus sound identical, but they're two different words. Mucus is the noun. That's the stuff. M-U-C-U-S. But an adjective that means having to do with mucus or producing mucus is mucus, M-U-C-O-U-S, like mucous membrane. But anyway, these cells produce mucus, and they have these cilia beating. The mucus is sticky. So debris that you breathe in with the air, whether it's smoke or microorganisms or whatever, that's fairly big compared to the gas molecules, and so it sticks pretty easily to the mucus. That keeps it from going into your lungs. And then the beating, continuous beating of the cilia sweeps that mucus with all the junk that stuck to it upward toward your throat, and you, throughout the day, are continuously swallowing. And that puts all of that debris into your stomach for disposal, basically. If there's anything living in that stuff, like microorganisms that might harm you, putting them in your stomach is the ideal place to deal with that because of the really low pH. Only certain species can survive that. It'll kill most things. So that's why we're swallowing throughout the day. In 22, we can see the molecular architecture involved in a cilium. This is a real photomicrograph of a cutaway view, but if you look at the cartoon view, it's easier to understand what's happening here. Notice that microtubules are involved in this as well. These yellow things are just like the microtubules that make up the cytoskeleton. And these red Y-shaped things are motor proteins, just like the ones I told you about, that move things around in cells. But this explains why a cilium is able to bend back and forth continuously, which is what cilia do. I can kind of illustrate it with a piece of paper. If you notice that these motor proteins shown in just this example pair of microtubules, the walking and the feet of the motor protein are walking along this one microtubule, right? But instead of carrying a vesicle, they're all sharing the load by being connected to the other microtubule. So if that's all you had, then one microtubule would simply slip past the other, right, as they walk along the first microtubule. But there are also these blue proteins that you can see right here anchoring them in place. So instead of doing this, which would just slip past each other, since they're connected, which is analogous to a folded piece of paper, it's connected, right? And therefore, when you try to walk it along, it will bend instead of slipping. And so that's that's how these cilia continuously do that. It's the same mechanism, though, as moving things around in the cell along microtubules. Cartoon view of what I just showed you here. If it weren't for these blue anchoring proteins holding the two microtubules together so that they don't just slip past each other, there wouldn't be the bending. But that continuously requires ATP as well. Like anything that, just about anything that happens in a cell, it doesn't happen for free. You have to spend energy to do it. Slide 24 is just a micrograph of one of these microvilli that I talked about, and it shows you that in the interior of the microvillus, there are these microfilaments that make up part of the cytoskeleton, and they are then anchored to other components of the cytoskeleton in the main bulk of the cell. So it gives it some structure. These aren't just totally flaccid microvilli flapping around. They have some structure to them. What I was just showing you with my thumbs a little bit ago is shown here at the top of this. This is just the functional unit of a muscle cell. This is much smaller than the cell. A cell would have this arrangement many, many thousands of times along its length. But these two boundaries are what I was representing with my thumb. And these purple and orangish microfilaments are what either overlap less or more in order to bring these things together, or if something that, that's the only thing they can do on their own is bring them together. That's what they use energy for. That's what I meant by saying muscles can only pull. But if there's some other force, like gravity, then it will pull it back. You know, like in our body, you know, if keeping my elbow flexed like this requires energy. If I stop using that, then just gravity will stretch it back. Or another muscle, by pulling in the opposite way, can stretch the muscle that it's opposite to. Similar arrangement, though, using these microfilaments and the overlap between them allows for amoeboid movement, which you see in B. An amoeba is not a particular species. We use the word just to mean to refer to any cell, whether it's a free-living cell or not, that continuously changes shape in order to move around. And it's able to change this shape because of these microfilaments interacting in the cytoskeleton. It can drastically change the shape. And similarly, a plant cell can undergo what's called cytoplasmic streaming. And you can easily witness this if you look at a slide of a plant cell that's alive. Just in response to the light of the microscope, it will undergo cytoplasmic streaming to move the chloroplasts around in order to get them on the nearest the light. Now we've mentioned most of these things, which is why we're kind of racing through these slides. Here you see a closer view of these plasmodesmata, and now that multiple cells are shown, as opposed to the one that was shown when I originally explained these plasmodesmata, you can see clearly that they are passageways between adjacent cells, and since they're featured in all plant cells, basically, all living cells of the plant, that means all of the cytoplasm within the entire plant is actually one compartment, because, you know, the cytoplasm continues through the plasmodesmata to the next cell and to the next cell and so on. It's all one huge compartment, really. Slide 27 features cytoskeletal elements as well. All of these orange things, as you see, are microfilaments. They're part of the cytoskeleton within this one cell. This bottom here is the interior of the cell. The bluish background is the exterior of the cell. That's the extracellular fluid that you see. And the extracellular material, meaning the stuff that's outside of cells, between cells, is not simply fluid. There is extracellular fluid, but there is also what's called the extracellular matrix, which includes various proteins. So here you have proteins that, of course, were built inside of cells, because only cells can build proteins, but then exported out. And they, some of those are connected to these membrane-bound proteins, these integrins as they're labeled here. And then the integrins, the transmembrane proteins, or the membrane-bound proteins themselves, are then connected to the proteins that are inside the cell. And this is like strain relief. You know, if you had these proteins that are exterior to the cell connected to the membrane via these membrane-bound proteins, and you pulled on them, it would just rupture the membrane, right? But since the thing you're pulling on, the protein that's part of the membrane, is also connected to strong proteins within the cell, that's saving the plasma membrane from being ruptured, because the force of pulling is then transmitted to the inside of the cell. Keeps it from ripping. Well, this is not a cartoon view, just to show you that plasmodesmata are actually real. You can photograph them. These are clearly tunnels between the cells, but no new information. That brings us to animal intercellular junctions in 29. We talked about plant intercellular junctions, which are those plasmodesmata. Animals have various kinds, of which we'll talk about three, starting with desmosomes. Now, look at this picture. Orient yourself. We're looking at a cutaway view of the interior of just one cell of many. And a desmosome, well, there's several desmosomes shown here, but where it's labeled here, desmosome, that is a complex of proteins that are not only part of the membrane of this cell, but also part of the membrane of the next cell, holding the two together. So, in other words, functionally speaking, desmosomes are just like little spot welds. Do you know what I mean by spot welds? Rather than a long bead of welding. This is how car bodies are made. You take thin pieces of metal that are flimsy by themselves, and you make them a certain shape, and then you just here and there make a little spot weld to hold them together, and that's what makes the whole thing strong. But it keeps the cells to get the adjacent cells together, and specifically that happens often in a membrane. Now, membrane here, what I mean by membrane, there's two uses of the word. I've been using membrane a lot, the word membrane, but when I'm talking about, when up to now I've been talking about microscopic membranes that are either the plasma membrane, which is invisibly small, right, or the membrane of a membrane-bounded organelle. A phospholipid bilayer membrane is what I've been talking about up to now. That's a microscopic membrane. But there's also a macroscopic use of the word membrane, like skin is a membrane as well, that's made up of many cells. So it's much bigger than the phospholipid bilayer. That's what we're looking at here. This is one layer of cells. We're seeing one cell of that layer, but there's a bunch of them next to each other. All right, that's making up a macroscopic membrane. And desmosomes anchor adjacent cells within that membrane to each other, holding them in place. So they're strong. Just below that in the picture, we can see what are called gap junctions. And this is the animal version of plasmodesmata in plants. Gap junctions are also formed by protein complexes, but they form little tunnels, and just the right type of things are able to get through them. So it's also for intercellular communication, just like it is for plants with plasmodesmata. Good example of this in your body is that your heart uses these a lot. Heart muscles, individual heart muscles, abut each other at the ends. And where they come together, there are gap junctions between them so that ions can flow from one cell to the next. The flow of ions into a cell and out of a cell through its plasma membrane is how muscles eventually contract. That's the signal, the flow of ions. And so when this cell gets a signal, it's important for every muscle cell in the entire chamber, either an atrium or a ventricle of the heart, to contract as simultaneously as possible in order for it to function as a pump. If they're all just randomly firing, it's not going to pump blood. So you need to be able to excite a group of cells in one place originally and then quickly have that excitation spread throughout all the cells, and that's done through gap junctions. Now, the tight junction is shown above is the most complex structurally of these three. All of this blue beadwork is proteins. And remember, you're looking at the interior of one cell, but you don't see the entire cell, right? In three dimensions, this tight junction is kind of like double-sided tape. You're seeing just part of it, but it would go all the way around the periphery or the edge of that one cell. And all the cells that are next to it, since it's double-sided tape, would also be stuck to it, their own version of it. It's like a little piece of double-sided tape around each individual cell that's part of that macroscopic membrane, holding them together, but that's not the chief function. It does hold them together, but that job is already performed by desmosomes. That's really what holds them together well. What tight junctions are about is not really holding them together, but sealing them together. Now, if you are a particle trying to get through the macroscopic membrane, like skin, for instance, let me just draw a couple layers of cells. So this is a macroscopic membrane, right, made up of many cells. You're a particle and you'd like to get from here to here through the membrane. If there's any chance of that, there's two possibilities. You can go by what is called the cellular route or the paracellular route. Para means next to, like paralegal, for instance. The cellular route would require the particle to enter a cell, meaning going through its plasma membrane, go through the distance of that cell, exit it out the other end, enter the next cell in the layer, and so on, until it's finally through the macroscopic membrane. Cellular route, in other words, involves going through cells. The paracellular route would be not entering any cells, but trying to go through the little gaps between cells. That's paracellular. Well, the tight junctions are there to block that paracellular route. So if you had this sticky tape, you know, all around this region, right here is where the block is. So something might be able to slip in there up to the tight junction, but it would be blocked at that point. And therefore, by blocking the paracellular route, the only way something can get through is through the cellular route, and the cells themselves have control over what can enter them or not. So it really makes the membrane the boss of what is actually going to be able to get through. Not shown here, by the way, but similar to desmosomes are things that are called hemidesmosomes, which means half of a desmosome. That's not anchoring two adjacent cells. It's anchoring one cell, like this one, to the basement membrane, as this brown thing is called, this extracellular matrix part. That's what the membrane is built on. And so it holds that bottom layer of cells, or the only layer, if there's one layer, to that basement membrane. Similar structure, it's just not between two cells, so it's hemidesmosome. Oh, looks like we're done. The 30 is one of these summary slides. So I don't read these to you, but take a look at it if you want to while studying. That means there's just one chapter left, right?